Chapter 42. A Missing Leaf. Perrin stood near the Tuathuan wagons under bright sunlight, alone, and there was no arrow in his side, no pain. Among the wagons, firewood was stacked, ready to be lit beneath iron cookpots, hanging from tripods, and clothes hung from wash lines. There were no people or horses. He wore neither coat nor shirt, but a blacksmith's long leather vest that left his arms bare. It could have been any dream, perhaps, except that he was aware it was a dream. And he knew the feel of the wolf dream, the reality and solidity of it, from the long grass around his boots to the breeze out of the west that ruffled his curly hair, to the scattered ash and hemlock. The tinker's gaudy wagons did not seem real, though. They had an air of insubstantiability, a feel that they might shimmer and be gone any moment. They never remained long in one place, tinkers. No soil held them. Wondering how much the land held him, he rested a hand on his axe and looked down in surprise. The heavy blacksmith's hammer hung in the loop on his belt, not the axe. He frowned. Once he would have chosen that way, had even thought he had, but surely no more. The axe. He had chosen the axe. Hammerhead suddenly became half-moon blade and thick spike, flickered back to stout cylinder of cold steel, fluttered between. Finally it stopped, as his axe, and he exhaled slowly. That had never happened before. Here he could change things as he wanted with ease, things about himself, at least. "And I want the axe," he said firmly. "The axe." Looking around, he could just see a farmhouse to the south and deer browsing the barley field, surrounded by a rough stone wall. There was no feel of wolves, and he did not call Hopper. The wolf might or might not come, or even hear, but Slayer could well be out there somewhere. A bristling quiver abruptly tugged at his belt opposite the axe, and he had a stout longbow in his hand with a broadhead arrow nocked. A long leather bracer covered his left forearm. Nothing moved except those deer. "Not likely I'll wake soon," he muttered to himself. Whatever that stuff was that Fael had fed him, it had taken him right off. He remembered it as clearly as if he had watched over her shoulder. "Fed it to me like I was a babe," he growled. "Women." He took one of those long strides, the land blurred around him, and stepped into the farmyard. Two or three chickens scattered, running as if they had already gone feral. The rock-walled sheepfold stood empty, and both thatched-roofed barns were barred shut. Despite curtains still at the windows, the two-story farmhouse had the look of emptiness. If this was a true reflection of the waking world, and the wolf dream usually was, in an odd way, the people here had been gone for days. Fael was right. His warning had spread beyond the places he had gone. "Fael," he murmured wonderingly. "Daughter of a lord. No, not just a lord. 3 times a lord, a general, and uncle to a queen. Light, that makes her a queen's cousin. And she loved a simple blacksmith. Women were wondrous strange." Seeking to see how far the word had spread, he zigzagged more than halfway to Devon Ride, a mile or so at a stride, doubling back and crisscrossing his own path. Most farms he saw had that same emptiness. Less than 1 in 5 showed signs of habitation, doors open and windows up, wash hung out on a line, dolls or hoops or carved wooden horses lying around a doorstep. The toys especially made his stomach clench. Even if they had not believed his warning, surely there were enough burned farms about to tell them the same. Tumbled heaps of charred timbers, soot-black chimneys like stark dead fingers. Bending to replace a doll with a smiling glass face and a flower-embroidered dress, some woman had loved her daughter to do all that tiny needlework. He blinked. The same doll still sat on the fieldstone steps where he had picked it up. As he reached out, the one in his hand faded and vanished. Flashes of black in the sky cut short his amazement. Ravens, 20 or 30 together, winging toward the westward, toward the mountains of mist, where he had first seen Slayer. He watched coldly while the ravens dwindled to black specks and disappeared. Then he set off after them. Long racing strides carried him 5 miles each, the land a blur except in the moment between one step and the next, into the thick-treed, rocky westwood, across the scrub-covered sandhills, into the cloud-capped mountains, where fir and pine and leatherleaf forested valleys and slopes, to the very valley where he had first seen the man Hopper called Slayer, to the mountainside where he had returned from Tyr. The waygate stood there, closed. The Avendasaura leaf seemingly just one among a myriad of intricately carved leaves and vines. Scattered trees, wizened and wind-sculpted, dotted the sparse soil along the glazed stone where Manetherin had been burned away. Sunlight sparkled on the waters of the Manetherin drell below. A faint wind up the valley brought him the scent of deer, rabbits, foxes. Nothing moved that he could see. On the point of leaving, he stopped. The Avendasaura leaf. One leaf. Loyal had locked the waygate by placing both leaves on this side. He turned, and his hackles rose. The waygate stood open, twin masses of living greenery stirring in the breeze, exposing that dull, silvery surface. His reflection shimmered in it. How? He wondered. Loyal locked the bloody thing. Unaware of crossing the distance, suddenly he was right at the waygate. There was no trefoil leaf among the verdant tangle on the inside of the two gates. Strange to think that at that moment in the waking world, someone or something was passing through where he stood. Touching the dull surface, he grunted. It might as well have been a mirror. His hand slid across it as across the smoothest glass. From the corner of his eye, he caught the Avendasaura leaf suddenly in its place on the inside, and leaped back just as the waygate began swinging shut. Someone or something had come out or gone in. Out. It has to be out. He wanted to doubt that it was more trollocs and fades coming into the two rivers. The gates merged, became stone carvings again. A sense of being watched was all the warning he had. He jumped, a half-seen image of black streaking through where his chest had been, an arrow. Jumped in one of those world-blurring stretches, landed on a far slope, and jumped again, out of the valley of Manetherin into a stand of towering fir, and again. Running, he thought furiously, picturing the valley in his mind, and that brief glimpse of the arrow. It had come from that direction, at that angle when it reached him. So it had to have come from... A final bound took him back onto a slope above Manetherin's grave, crouching among meager, wind-slanted pines, with bow ready to draw. Below him, among the stunted trees and boulders, the arrow had been fired. Slayer had to be down there somewhere. He had to be down... Without thinking, Perrin leaped away, the mountains a smear of gray and brown and green. Almost, he growled. Almost, he had duplicated his mistake in the waterwood, thinking again an enemy would move to suit him, wait where he wanted. This time he ran as hard as he could, only 3 flashing strides to the edge of the sandhills, hoping he had not been seen. This time he circled wide, coming back higher on that same mountainside, up where the air felt thin and cold and the few trees were thick-trunked bushes 50 paces or more apart, up above where a man might set himself to watch for another who meant to sneak up on the place that arrow had fired. And there his quarry was, 100 paces below, dark-haired and dark-coated, a tall man crouched beside a table-sized granite outcrop, his own half-drawn bow in hand, studying the slope farther down with eager patience. This was the first time Perrin had gotten a good look at him. 100 paces was little distance for his eyes. This Slayer's high-collared coat had a borderland cut, and his face looked enough like Lan's to be the warder's brother's. Only Lan had no brothers, no living kin at all that Perrin knew. And if he had had any, they would not have been here. A borderlander, though. Maybe Shinaran, though his hair was long, not shaved to a top knot, and was held back by a braided leather cord just like Lan's. He could not be Melkiri. Lan was the last living Melkiri. Wherever he came from, Perrin felt no compunction at all in drawing his bow, broadhead point aimed at Slayer's back. This man had tried to kill him from ambush. A downhill shot could be tricky. Perhaps he had taken too long, or perhaps the fellow felt his cold gaze, but suddenly Slayer became a blur, streaking away east. With a curse, Perrin pursued. 3 strides to the sandhills, another into the westwood. Among the oaks and leatherleaf and underbrush, Slayer seemed to vanish. Halting, Perrin listened. Silence. The squirrels and birds had gone still. He inhaled deeply. A small herd of deer had passed that way not long since, and a faint tinge of something, human but too cold for a man, too emotionless, a scent that tickled his mind with familiarity. Slayer was somewhere close. The air lay as still as the forest, no stir of breeze to tell him which way that scent came. A neat trick, Golden Eyes, locking the waygate. Perrin tensed, ears straining. No telling from where in this dense growth that voice had come. Not so much as a leaf rustled. If you knew how many of the Shadow Rot died trying to get out of the ways there, it would lift your heart. Machin Shin feasted at that gate, Golden Eyes. But not a good enough trick. You saw. The gate is open now. There. Off to the right. Perrin slipped through the trees as silently as he had when he had hunted here. It was only a few hundred to begin, Golden Eyes. Just enough to keep those fool white cloaks off balance and see that the renegade died. Slayer's voice became angry. The shadow consume me if that man does not have more luck than the White Tower. Abruptly he chuckled. But you, Golden Eyes, your presence was a surprise. There are those who want your head on a pike. Your precious 2 rivers will be harrowed from end to end now to root you out. What do you say to that, Golden Eyes? Perrin froze close beside the gnarled trunk of a great oak. Why was the man talking so much? Why was he talking at all? He's drawing me right to him. Putting his back against the oak's thick bole, he studied the forest. No movement. Slayer wanted him to come nearer. No doubt into an ambush. And he wanted to find the man and rip his throat out. Yet it could easily be himself who died. And if that happened, no one would know the waygate was open, and Trollocs coming by hundreds, maybe even thousands. He would not play Slayer's game. With a mirthless smile, he stepped out of the wolf dream, telling himself to wake, and Fael twined her arms around his neck and nipped his beard with small white teeth, while Tinker's fiddles sang some wild, heated tune around the campfires. Isla's powder. I can't wake up. Awareness that it was a dream faded. Laughing, he scooped Fael up in his arms and carried her into the shadows where the grass was soft. Waking was a slow process, wrapped around the dull pain filling his side. Daylight streamed in at the small windows. Bright light. Morning. He tried to sit up and fell back with a groan. Fael sprang up from a low stool. Her dark eyes looked as if she had not slept. Lie still, she said. You did enough thrashing in your sleep. I have not kept you from rolling over and driving that thing the rest of the way through you. Just to watch you do it now you're awake. Ivan stood leaning against the doorframe, like a dark blade. Help me up, Perrin said. Talking hurt, but so did breathing, and he had to talk. I have to get to the mountains, to the waygate. She put a hand to his forehead, frowning. No fever, she murmured. Then more strongly, "You are going to Emmons Field, where one of the Aes Sedai can heal you. You are not going to kill yourself trying to ride into the mountains with an arrow in you. Do you hear me? If I hear one more word about mountains or waygates, I will have Isla mix something that will put you back to sleep, and you will travel on a litter. I am not certain you should not anyway. The Trollocs, Fael. The waygate is open again. I have to stop them."
The woman did not even hesitate before shaking her head.
"You can do nothing about it, the state you are in. It is Emmons Field for you. But me no buts, Perrin Abara. Not another word on it."
He ground his teeth. The worst was that she was right. If he could not rise from a bed alone, how could he stay in the saddle as far as Manetherin?
"Emmons Field," he said graciously, but she still sniffed and muttered something about pig-headed. What did she want? "I was bloody gracious. Burn her for stubborn."
"So there will be more Trollocs," Ivan said musingly. He did not ask how Perrin knew. Then he shook his head as if dismissing Trollocs. "I will tell the others you are awake." He slipped out, closing the door behind him.
"Am I the only one who sees the danger?" Perrin muttered.
"I see an arrow in you," Fael said firmly.
The reminder gave him a twinge. He just stifled a groan. And she gave a satisfied nod. Satisfied. He wanted to be up and on the way immediately. The sooner he was healed, the sooner he could see to closing the waygate again, permanently this time. Fael insisted on feeding him breakfast, a broth thick with mashed vegetables suitable for a toothless infant, one spoon at a time, with pauses to wipe his chin. She would not let him feed himself, and whenever he protested or asked her to go faster, she shoved the words back into his mouth with a spoonful of pap. She would not even let him wash his own face. By the time she got around to brushing his hair and combing his beard, he had settled on dignified silence.
"You are pretty when you sulk," she said,
and pinched his nose. Isla, in green blouse and blue skirt this morning, climbed into the wagon with his coat and shirt, both cleaned and mended. To his irritation, he had to let the two women help him don them. He had to let them help him sit up to don them, the coat unbuttoned and the shirt not tucked in, but bunched around the arrow stub.
"Thank you, Isla," he said, fingering the neat darns. "This is fine needlework."
"It is," she agreed. "Fael has a deft touch with a needle."
Fael colored, and he grinned, thinking of how fiercely she had told him she would never mend his clothes. A glint in her eye held his tongue. Sometimes silence was the wiser course.
"Thank you, Fael," he said gravely instead.
She blushed even redder. Once they had him on his feet, he reached the door easily enough, but he had to let the two women half support him to climb down the wooden steps. At least the horses were saddled, and all the Two Rivers lads gathered, bows slung on their backs. With clean faces and clothes, and only a few bandages out where they showed. A night with the Tuathuan had obviously been good for their spirits, too, even those who still looked as though they could not walk 100 paces. The haggardness that had been in their eyes yesterday was only a shadow now. Will had each arm around a pretty big-eyed tinker girl, of course, and Ban Luan, with his nose and a bandage around his head, making his dark hair stand up in a brush, held hands with another, smiling shyly. Most of the others held bowls of thick vegetable stew and spoons, shoveling away.
"This is good, Perrin," Danil said, giving up his empty bowl to a tinker woman.
She gestured as if to ask the beanpole fellow whether he wanted more, and he shook his head but said,
"I don't think I could ever get enough of it, do you?"
"I had my fill," Perrin told him sourly.
Mashed vegetables and broth.
"The Tinker girls danced last night," Danil's cousin Tel said, wide-eyed. "All the unmarried women, and some of the married. You should have seen it, Perrin."
"I've seen Tinker women dance before, Tel." Apparently, he had not kept his voice clear of what he had felt watching them, for Fael said dryly,
"You've seen the Taganza, have you? Someday, if you are good, I may dance the Sassara for you, and show you what a dance really is.
Isla gasped in recognition of the name, and Fail went even redder than she had inside. Perrin pursed his lips. If this Sassara set the heart pounding any harder than the Tinker Women's swaying, hip-rolling dance, the Taganza, was it? He definitely would like to see Fail dance it. He carefully did not look at her. Rain came, in the same bright green coat, but trousers redder than any red Perrin had ever seen before. The combination made his head ache.
"Twice you have visited our fires, Perrin, and for the second time you go without a farewell feast. You must come again soon so we can make up for it."
Pushing away from Fail and Isla, he could stand by himself at least. He put a hand on the wiry man's shoulder.
"Come with us, Rain. No one in Emmonsfield will harm you. At worst, it's safer than out here with the Trollocs."
Rain hesitated, then shook himself, muttering,
"I do not know how you can even make me consider such things."
Turning, he spoke loudly.
"People, Perrin has asked us to come with him to his village, where we will be safe from Trollocs. Who wishes to go?"
Shocked faces stared back at him. Some women gathered their children close, and the children hid in their skirts as if the very idea frightened them.
"You see, Perrin," Rain said, "for us, safety lies in moving, not in villages. I assure you, we do not spend 2 nights in one place, and we will travel all day before stopping again."
"That may not be enough, Rain."
The Mahdi shrugged.
"Your concern warms me, but we will be safe if the light wills it. The way of the leaf is not only to do no violence," Isla said gently, "but to accept what comes. The leaf falls in its proper time uncomplaining. The light will keep us safe for our time."
Perrin wanted to argue with them, but behind all the warmth and compassion on their faces lay a stony firmness. He thought he would get Bane and Chiad to don dresses and give up their spears, or Gaul too, before he made these people budge an inch. Rain shook Perrin's hand, and with that the Tinker Woman began hugging the Two Rivers lads, and Ivan too. And the Tinker Men began shaking hands, all laughing and saying goodbyes and wishing everyone a safe journey, hoping they would come again. Almost all the men did. Aram stood off to one side, frowning to himself, hands thrust into his coat pockets. The last time Perrin met him, he had seemed to have a sour streak. Odd for a Tinker. The men did not content themselves with shaking Fail's hand, but hugged her. Perrin kept his face smooth when some of the younger men became overly enthusiastic, only grinding his teeth a little. He managed to smile. No woman much younger than Isla hugged him. Somehow, even while Fail was letting some skinny, gaudy-coated tinker fold his arms around her and try to squeeze her flat, she stood guard on him like a mastiff. Women without gray in their hair took one look at her face and chose someone else. Meanwhile, Will appeared to be kissing every woman in the camp. So was Ban, and his nose. Even Ivan was enjoying himself, for that matter. It would serve Fail right if one of those fellows cracked a rib for her. Finally, the tinkers moved back, except for Rain and Isla, opening a space around the Two Rivers folk. The wiry, gray-haired man bowed formally, hands to chest.
"You came in peace. Depart now in peace. Always will our fires welcome you. The way of the leaf is peace."
"Peace be on you always," Perrin replied, "and on all the people. Light be it so. I will find the song, or another will find the song, but the song will be sung this year or in a year to come."
He wondered if there had ever been a song, or if the Tuathuan had begun their endless journey seeking something else. Elias had told him they did not know what song, only that they would know it when they found it.
Let them find safety, at least that. "As it once was, so shall it be again, world without end."
"World without end," the Tuathuan responded in a solemn murmur. "World and time without end."
A few final hugs and handshakes were handed round, while Ivan and Fail were helping Perrin up on stepper. A few last kisses collected by Will. And Ban.
Ban? And his nose.
Others, the badly wounded, were half-lifted onto their horses, with tinkers waving as if to old neighbors off on a long journey. Rain came to shake Perrin's hand.
"Will you not reconsider?" Perrin asked.
"I remember hearing you say once there was wickedness loose in the world. It's worse now, Rain. And here."
"Peace be on you, Perrin," Rain replied, smiling.
"And on you," he said sadly.
The Aiel did not appear until they were a mile north of the Tinker camp, Bane and Chiad looking to Fail before trotting ahead to their usual place. Perrin was not sure what they thought might have happened to her among Tuathuan. Gaul moved in beside Stepper, striding easily. The party was not moving very fast, with nearly half the men walking. He glanced at Ivan measuringly, as usual, before turning to Perrin.
"Your injury is well?"
His injury hurt like fury. Every step his horse took jolted that arrowhead.
"I feel fine," he said, not gritting his teeth. "Maybe we'll have a dance in Emmons Field tonight. And you? Did you pass a good night playing Maiden's Kiss?"
Gaul stumbled and nearly fell on his face.
"What is the matter?" "Who did you hear suggest this game?" the Aielman said quietly, staring straight ahead.
"Chiad. Why?"
"Chiad," Gaul muttered. "The woman is Goshin. Goshin!"
"I should take her back to Hot Springs as Guy Shine." The words sounded angry, but not his odd tone.
"Chiad. Will you tell me what is the matter?" "A Murdral has less cunning than a woman," Gaul said in a flat voice, "and a Trolloc fights with more honor." After a moment he added, in a fierce undertone, "And a goat has more sense."
Quickening his pace, he ran forward to join the two maidens. He did not speak to them, as far as Perrin could make out, only slowed to walk alongside.
"Did you understand any of that?" Perrin asked Ivan.
The warder shook his head. Fail sniffed.
"If he thinks to make trouble for them, they will hang him by his heels from a branch to cool off."
"Did you understand it?" Perrin asked her.
She walked along, neither looking at him nor answering, which he took to mean she did not.
"I think I might have to find Rain's camp again. It has been a long time since I saw the Taganza. It was interesting."
She muttered something under her breath, but he caught it.
"You could do with hanging by your heels yourself."
He smiled down at the top of her head.
"But I won't have to. You promised to dance this Sassara for me."
Her face went crimson.
"Is it anything close to the Taganza? I mean, there is no point otherwise."
"You muscle-brained oaf,"
she snapped, glaring up at him.
"Men have thrown their hearts and fortunes at the feet of women who dance the Sassara. If Mother suspected I knew it."
Her teeth clicked shut as though she had said too much, and her head whipped back to face forward. Scarlet mortification covered her, from her dark hair down to the neck of her dress.
"Then there isn't any reason for you to dance it," he said quietly. "My heart and fortune, such as they are, already lie at your feet."
Fail missed a step, then laughed softly and pressed her cheek against his booted calf.
"You are too clever for me," she murmured. "One day I will dance it for you and boil the blood in your veins."
"You already do that," he said, and she laughed again.
Pushing her arm behind his stirrup, she hugged his leg to her as she walked. After a while, even the thought of Fail dancing, he extrapolated from the tinker dance, it must be something to top that, could not compete with the pain in his side. Every stride Stepper took was agony. He held himself upright. it seemed to hurt a fraction less that way. Besides, he did not want to spoil the lift the Tuathuan had given everyone's spirits. The other men were sitting up straight in their saddles, too, even those who had been hunched over and clinging the day before. And Ban and Danil and the others walked with heads up. He would not be the first to slump. Will began to whistle coming home from Tarwin's Gap, and three or four more took it up. After a time, Ban began to sing in a clear, deep voice. My home is waiting there for me and the girl I left behind. Of all the treasure that waits for me, that's what I want to find. Her eyes so merry and her smile so sweet, her hugs so warm and her ankle neat, her kisses hot, now there's a treat. If there's a treasure greater, it lies not in my mind. Moore joined in on the second verse until everyone sang, even Ivan. And Fail. Not Perrin, of course. He had been told often enough that he sounded like a stepped-on frog singing. Some even fell into step with the music. Oh, I have seen Stark Tarwin's Gap and the Trolloc's raving horde. I have stood for the Halfman's charge and walked on death's cold board. But a winsome lass, she waits for me for a dance and a kiss neath the apple tree. Perrin shook his head. A day before, they had been ready to run and hide. Today they sang about a battle so long ago that it had left no memory but this song in the two rivers. Perhaps they were becoming soldiers. They would have to, unless he managed to close that waygate. Farms began to appear more often, closer together, until they traveled along hard-packed dirt between fields bordered by hedges or low, rough stone walls. Abandoned farms. No one here clung to the land. They came to the old road, which ran north from the White River, the Manetherandrel, through Devon Ride to Emmons Field, and at last began to see sheep in the pastures. Great clumps, like a dozen men's flocks gathered together, with 10 shepherds, where there once would have been one, and half of them grown men. Bow-armed shepherds watched them pass, singing at the top of their lungs, not knowing quite what to make of it. Perrin did not know what to make of his first view of Emmons Field, and neither did the other two rivers men, from the way their singing faltered and died. The trees, fences, and hedges closest to the village were simply gone, cleared away. The westernmost houses of Emmons Field had once stood among the trees on the edge of the Westwood. The oaks and leatherleaf between the houses remained, but now the forest's brim stood 500 paces away, a long bowshot, and axes rang loud as men pushed it back farther. Row on row of waist-high stakes, driven into the ground at an angle, surrounded the village, a little out from the houses, and presented a continuous hedge of sharpened points, except where the road ran in. At intervals behind the stakes, men stood like sentries, some wearing bits of old armor, or leather shirts sewn with rusty steel discs, a few in dented old steel caps with boar spears, or halberds, rooted out of attics, or bush hooks, fitted to long poles. Other men, and boys, were up on some of the thatched roofs with bows. They stood when they saw Perrin and the others coming, and shouted to people below. Beside the road, behind the stakes, stood a contraption of wood and thick twisted rope, with a nearby pile of stones bigger than a man's head. Ivan noticed Perrin frowning at it as they came closer.
Catapult, the warder said. 6 so far. Your carpenters knew what to do once Tomas and I showed them. The stakes will hold off charging Trollocs or White Cloaks, either one.
He might have been discussing the prospects for more rain.
I told you your village was preparing to defend itself.
Fail sounded fiercely proud, as though it were her village.
A hard people for such a soft land. They could almost be Saldaean. Moraine always said, Manetherin's blood runs strong here still.
Perrin could only shake his head.
The hard-packed dirt streets were nearly crowded enough for a city, the gaps between houses filled with carts and wagons,
and through open doors and unshuttered windows he could see more people. The crowd parted before Ivan and the Aiel, and rustling whispers accompanied them along the street.
"It's Perrin Goldeneyes! Perrin Goldeneyes! Perrin Goldeneyes!"
He wished they would not do that. These people knew him, some of them. What did they think they were doing? There was horse-faced Nisa Aellen, who had paddled his 10-year-old backside that time Matt talked him into stealing one of her gooseberry pies. And there was pink-cheeked, big-eyed Celia Cole, the first girl he had ever kissed and still pleasingly plump. And Pelle Dare, with his pipe and his bald head, who had taught Perrin how to catch trout with his hands. And Daze Conger herself, a tall, wide woman who made Elsbeth Lujan seem soft, with her husband Wit, a scrawny man overshadowed as always by his wife. And they were all staring at him and whispering to the people from off who might not know who he was. When old Sen Bui lifted a little boy up on his shoulder, pointing at Perrin and talking enthusiastically to the boy, Perrin groaned. They had all gone mad. Townsfolk trailed after Perrin and the others, around them, in a parade that rode a swell of murmurs. Chickens scurried every which way under people's feet. Bawling calves and pigs squealing in pens behind the houses competed with the noise of the humans. Sheep crowded the green, and black and white milk cows cropped the grass in company with flocks of geese, gray and white. And in the middle of the green rose a tall pole, the red-bordered white banner at its peak, rippling lazily, displaying a red wolf's head. He looked at Fayil, but she shook her head, as surprised as he.
"A symbol."
Perrin had not heard Varen's approach, though now he caught hushed whispers of Aes Sedai floating around her. Ivan did not look surprised. People stared at her with awe-filled eyes.
"People need symbols," Varen went on, resting a hand on Stepper's shoulder. "When Elana told a few of the villagers how much Trollocs fear wolves, everyone seemed to think this banner a grand idea. Don't you, Perrin?"
Was there a dryness in her voice then? Her dark eyes looked up at him bird-like. A bird watching a worm?
"I wonder what Queen Morgaze will think of that," Fayil said. "This is part of Andor. Queens seldom like strange banners being raised in their realms."
"That's nothing but lines on a map," Perrin told her.
It was good to be still. The throbbing from the arrowhead seemed to have abated somewhat. "I did not even know we were supposed to be part of Andor until I went to Camelon. I doubt many people here do."
"Rulers have a tendency to believe maps, Perrin."
There was no doubt of the dryness in Fael's tone.
"When I was a child, there were parts of Saldaea that had not seen a taxman in 5 generations. One's father could turn his attention from the Blight for a time. Tenobia made sure they knew who their queen was."
"This is the Two Rivers," he said, grinning, "not Saldaea."
They did sound very fierce up there in Saldaea. As he turned back to Varen, the grin became a frown.
"I thought you were hiding who you are." He could not say which was more disturbing, Aes Sedai there in secret or Aes Sedai in the open.
The Aes Sedai's hand hovered an inch from the broken-off arrow jutting from his side. Something tingled around the wound.
"Oh, this is not good," she murmured. "Caught in the rib and some infection in spite of that poultice. This needs Elana, I think."
She blinked and pulled her hand back. The tingle went too.
"What? Hiding? Oh, with what has been stirred up here now, we could hardly remain hidden. I suppose we could have gone away. You wouldn't want that, would you?"
There was that sharp, considering bird-like stare again. He hesitated and finally sighed.
"I suppose not."
"Oh, that is good to hear," she said with a smile.
"Why did you really come here, Varen?"
She did not seem to hear him, or did not want to.
"Now, we need to see to that thing in you, and these other lads need to be looked after, too. Elana and I will see to the worst, but..."
The men with him were as stunned by what they found here as he was. Ban scratched his head at the banner, and a few just stared around in amazement. Most looked at Varen, though, wide-eyed and uneasy. They had surely heard the whispers of Aes Sedai. Perrin was not escaping those looks entirely himself, he realized, talking to an Aes Sedai as though she were just any village woman. Varen considered them right back, then suddenly, without seeming to look, reached behind her to snatch a girl of about 10 or 12 out of the onlookers. The girl, her long dark hair caught up with blue ribbons, went rigid with shock.
"You know Daes Conger, girl?" Varen said. "Well, you find her and tell her there are injured men who need a wisdom's herbs. And tell her to jump. You tell her I'll have no patience with her airs. Do you have that? Off with you."
Perrin did not recognize the girl, but evidently she did know Daes, because she flinched at the message. But Varen was an Aes Sedai. After a moment of weighing, Daes Conger against an Aes Sedai, the girl scampered away into the crowd.
"And Alana will take care of you," Varen said, peering up at him again.
He wished she did not sound as though there might be two meanings to that.